Welcome to the System Speak podcast, a podcast about dissociative identity disorder. If you are new to the podcast, we recommend starting at the beginning episodes and listen in order to hear our story and what we have learned through this endeavor. Current episodes may be more applicable to longtime listeners and are likely to contain more advanced topics, emotional or other triggering content, and/or reference earlier episodes that provide more context to what we are currently learning and experiencing. As always, please care for yourself during and after listening to the podcast. Thank you. How many pages of notes did you take?
Oh my goodness. Five typed.
Because we did the thing that we said, let's not do that thing. We did the thing.
Yeah, last night we said we are not going to go to that presentation. And then this morning we found ourselves in that presentation.
There we are.
Yeah.
I think it's because we saw Labyrinth. Don't go that way. We went straight to the castle.
We went straight to the
castle. Oh my goodness. Why? Why did we do that?
It was a blur. I don't know. I'm not sure how it happened.
It was very gentle and we were checking in. And it was like, I feel okay, and also this is a terrible idea.
Yeah. It didn't take long. Okay, I want a preference first. It was a really good presentation.
It was amazing.
Yes. The presenter is amazing.
What was it called?
The Self-Protective and Defense System of Children and Adolescents Affected by Complex Trauma by Ana Gomez.
Ana Gomez. Who has worked a lot and written with our friend Jill Hosey, mm-hmm. who also works with child and adolescent, prenatal even. Good, good stuff. Also, all relational trauma, because it is about the caregiver-child relationship.
Yeah.
So I think I remember vaguely you and I saying something about how we are learning to pay attention to our littles and something. I was being serious.
I know you were. I'm sorry.
And something about outside kids. And we thought maybe we could go to part of this presentation and it would be helpful.
Yeah.
What we did not know was that it was just going to rip off the scab and stab us in the belly. It was awful.
Over and over and over again.
Right.
Like, truth bombs, it was like carpet bombing.
It was brutal.
Yeah.
So to be fair, Anna's presentation was amazing. It's not that we dislike Ana.
No.
It is that the presentation was epic and it was super activating because it was so true to experience.
Yeah.
So I want to say that sometimes there are presentations where it's like we disagree with this part or we disagree with this part, but these things are good. Other presentations we've been like, when you and I have done recaps, we're like, no, that was terrible. Like, I feel like we've been pretty honest about things. But those presentations where it is very left brain and very cognitive of these are the pieces that felt true and make sense and these are the pieces that just don't match, are not congruent with lived experience, those are very cognitive ones, I feel like. Very theory, very talking about, and we can sort of intellectualize and debate and discuss. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The problem with this one is that it was so right brain and experiential that it was super activating. And she warned of that.
Yeah.
She was really respectful about that. In the end, I had to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Twice, actually. In the first section before the break, I needed to get up. I went and I got a drink of water and I went to the bathroom and I walked around. I stopped to wave at Christine Forner for mm-hmm. a minute in her presentation and then made my way back. Mm-hmm. And then after the break, I tried to stay again. I was updating and trying to share in the community. And then I was like, nope, I'm done here. Yeah. I just cannot. And so I had to just leave altogether. You were taking copious notes as a way of intentional flight and coping.
And trying to retain, because I knew if I didn't, it would all be gone.
Right. Yeah. Well, also, seriously, not teasing, it was a way to help you stay present.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I was doing with sharing things in the community. It was a way to help me stay present and try to absorb, like, not process, but just receive the information. It made the information and the experience of it tolerable.
Yeah. Hmm. Tolerable-ish.
Tolerable-ish. Tolerable enough. Mm-hmm. It was still hard, and to be clear, before we've done this recap, we took a break. We changed into cozy clothes. We went for a lovely walk outside. It's a gorgeous day. I mean, for Texas, it could be so hot, but it's so nice.
Well, and by gorgeous, it is cloudy and windy and rained a bit, and it is lovely.
Feels like home.
Yeah, it's refreshing.
But I mean, for Texas, it's gorgeous, meaning... Yeah. It is not 120 degrees.
Right.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
So we got in our cozy clothes. We went for a nice walk so our bodies felt more regulated. We found amazing food. Mm-hmm. Do you want to share about your drink or no?
I found a drink called the Skittles Sangria. And it is literally candy wine. It was fabulous.
It was disgusting.
It was fabulous and really sweet.
And we found fantastic queso there.
We did. Queso number two, also delicious.
Queso number two was also delicious. Maybe the winner because of the ambiance in this little sidewalk cafe.
Out on the patio.
And then we walked back through the rain, which normally you would think, oh, that's uncomfortable. And it was a little cold and obviously wet. But it was just actually cozy and felt nice.
Kind of grounding.
It was very grounding.
Yeah.
We did come back curly.
A little bit.
A little curly. But I just want to say that part of the story before we jump into this information as part of self-care that I'm really proud of us because this was one of the things we were afraid of. Or not, totally afraid of. I tried to make it better, and then I was like, no, it's fear. Of that one of us or both of us would become dysregulated, and that we would have a relational or attachment rupture or crisis, not drama, but just from hurting and not know how to recover.
Yeah.
But we actually handled it really well.
Yeah.
And we talked about how you can't tell the baby it's safe.
Right.
And babies have to experience safety through being clean and warm and cozy and held.
And fed.
And fed. Mm-hmm. Clean and warm and cozy. That's where the cozy is. And fed and held.
Yeah.
And so we tried, and we have the same brains, right? Not because we're babies or because we're only littles. We are adults with all of this going on. But all of us, all of humanity, have those same brains that infants have.
Right.
So when we get, one thing you and I have been practicing is that when we get dysregulated, going back to those basic things. And so we changed clothes. We were cozy and warm in our not conference clown clothes.
Like relaxing loungewear.
Right.
Athleisure wear.
Athleisure. And then we got good food. We found excellent queso, but we also had really good salads.
Yeah.
Like they had vegetables and kale and all kinds of stuff in it.
And protein in it.
And protein. Yeah. It was so good. So we got nutrition in our bodies. We also had fun food, which does address some little stuff too. But we got protein and actual vegetables and nutrients in us. Mm-hmm. And then we came back. It was just like, hold me. Like just cuddle. Doing the whole dang. And just safe, casual, we talked and laughed, and it really worked. Like, we felt better.
Yeah.
We're gonna mess it up doing this.
Well, we'll just redo it tonight. We have dinner, right? So we can just do it again at night.
Right. So we will care for ourselves again after this, but I'm really proud of us. Mm-hmm. Like, we did the thing.
We did. I think we get gold stars for that, right?
Total gold stars.
I'm giving myself a gold star for allowing you to walk me through that care.
Legit.
Yeah.
And I get a gold star for staying.
Yes.
I communicated.
Leaving when you needed to, but staying also when it was safe.
I said, I need to leave.
Yep.
I practiced, like, my lesson from the retreat, right? I communicated, I'm done here.
Yep.
I need to be excused. I will be in our room. Please text me if you need me. You will know where to find me. You are welcome to join me when you are also finished. But I'm done here. She was like, at the end, she was like, for the break, she was like, before we go, does anyone have any questions? And I texted Jill, Hosey, and Alexis, and I was like, could you just stop talking now? That's my question. I told her this after, and she laughed really hard. She thought it was funny. She was very kind and sweet.
Yeah. No bad feelings at all about her. Just the material was rough.
Absolutely. I also invited her to come on the podcast. So I can talk about this again.
Oh, fun.
But let's share. I'm actually going to let you lead the discussion only because you have the notes, but we can still discuss and banter and avoid as we always do.
Okay. Well, one of the first things I wrote down, she started out by talking about the different attachment styles, and we'll go into that.
But brutal, not like your mama's attachments. I mean, well, I guess it was your mama's attachment style is the whole point.
That's the whole point, yeah. So first, the very first thing I wrote down is she said, if we see the child as not ready. So first of all, she treats children, right? So she is talking about children as clients. And she said, if we see the child as not ready, then their defenses remain intact, and they will be, and those defenses that stay intact through childhood and adolescence and then into adulthood become a foundation for addiction. That's what she talked about. And so she said that we have a responsibility to identify the defense system and then work within it to help the child, instead of saying they're not ready for it, because they will never look ready, because they will always have their defense system active until there's intervention.
Right. And we'll come full circle to this later, but she works with children by working with the parents.
Yeah.
This is not like community-based state Medicaid help where the goal is to just see the kid as much as you can and maybe do some family sessions if you need to fill in the units. Right. This is literally to tend to a child, you need to care for the caregivers.
Yes.
And so that kept coming up, which was also uncomfortable. But we can talk about that piece later. When you're saying this about the child being ready, that is part of it. The child cannot be ready if the parent is not safe and regulated.
Right. Right.
So addiction, she was talking about the foundation of addiction being growing up as a child with a caregiver who has unresolved trauma, mm-hmm. and that is not acknowledged. Which I appreciate she added, because at first I panicked, because I'm like, I'm someone with lived experience. Does that mean all my children are going to have addiction issues? But she was like, no. Unresolved trauma that is not being tended to.
Right.
So I am very human. I make mistakes. I'm not the best parent in the world. All of my children will say that. And also, I'm really doing my best to work hard at tending to things and tending to them and repairing with them and being present with them.
Right.
So that is really important, and I think it's significant. Mm-hmm. So for those with addiction issues, I just want to say it one more time, because it's also brutal, so let's hear it again.
One more stab.
For those in the back, the foundation of addiction issues is having a caregiver who themselves have unresolved trauma that is not being tended to.
Yeah.
I also want to add before we go on that we did a couple weeks ago interview Crystals, who was in the community, and it's been good to reconnect with them. And they, on their episode, which will air, I think, in July, they talk about addiction a little bit. So that was a really good interview. So I don't necessarily have lived experience with that to really be able to speak to it much more. But she does. They do. Right. And we'll talk about it on the podcast, I think, the first Monday in July, I think.
Yeah. And I think one clarifying thing that Anna talked about was addiction is not only substance addiction, right? She talked about hoarding, addiction to an object, because an object is safer than a person for an attachment.
My mother had that.
Yeah. And addiction to, oh, we'll get to that one when we talk about the...
Okay. Also, things like food addiction and gaming addiction, sex addiction.
All different kinds.
And really, in context, thinking about addiction as trying to fulfill those needs for care and approval, which your brain translates to safety.
Yeah.
So, for example, if we go back to the conversation about a baby, and you can't tell a baby it's safe, it has to experience it through being clean, warm, fed, and held. So if you have, Anna didn't say this directly, but we've been talking about this in the crowd amongst the peoples and with some of our friends and colleagues here. If you have a caregiver with unresolved trauma, but they can function enough to do one of those, then you can lean towards one of those things. So maybe they're not as good at keeping you warm or fed or clean, but maybe they'll hold you or carry you around. That shapes into sex addiction. Maybe they're not good at holding you or caring for you or keeping you warm or clean, but they make sure you have a bottle or you're fed, maybe not properly, maybe it's bottle propping, and then that can look like food addiction. Or like that these really trace back to those early developmental experiences.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about some of the other ones as we go. But it was really interesting that she just started out with addiction. Like, I was not expecting that at all.
Right.
I was like, what just happened?
Right. We're talking about children. Why are we talking about addiction?
It was really interesting.
Yeah.
So, Ana Gomez, if you want to read more about that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm interrupting again. I also really appreciated, she's really good about citing her sources. Like, it wasn't just addiction, I think this, or addiction and dissociation of this was what I think. Like, she had lots of resources.
So the next little truth bomb that I typed down from her notes was that the absence of emotional regulation for children leads to the formation of defenses, and that children learn that their emotions and body sensations are dangerous, which then is the phobia of all those things we were talking about last night that made us not want to go to this presentation,
which was the phobia of having needs at all, phobia of attachment,
phobia of feelings. I'm going up to those slides really quick. Phobia of needs, phobia of affect, phobia of memories, phobia of attachment, and phobia of parts.
Oh my goodness.
Right? Welcome to the conference.
This is also why on my plenary, John O'Neill helped me add the Z-axis for emotional regulation on my chart that ranges from dysregulation to regulation as part of presence and awareness.
Yeah. Well, if awareness lets you know what your emotions and sensations are, but those have become dangerous because of your lack of emotional regulation through caregivers, you can't actually be aware of it. Does that make sense?
And that is why the phobia of these things, that because those things then become dangerous, that is why we are dissociated. Mm-hmm. And we're like, fine, we don't need any of those things. Yeah. We can just sail right through. Easy peasy.
Easy peasy.
Till you come to a conference.
Right. Okay. Are you ready?
No.
To talk about attachment systems?
No. Okay, clarifying question. Is this the part with the pictures that listed everything on the right? Mm-hmm. Or is this the animal pictures?
Both. They were in between. The animal pictures are not actually on her handout. They were just in the presentation.
Okay. So I feel like for each one, if it's okay with you, mm-hmm. we should read the slide that we saw first.
Uh-huh. And then the cartoon?
No, the one where it was like
avoidant attachment strategy?
Yes.
Yeah.
And literally just read through it first. People in the community, I posted pictures of it.
Okay.
But maybe just read through it first, and then as we discuss it and the notes, we can agonize in pain together. Let me pull mine up.
Okay.
Hold on, it'll make sounds when I'm clicking. The first one is which?
The first, avoidance.
Okay.
You
ready? Do you want me to read it?
No, I can read it, unless you want to.
It's the only notes I have.
Well, then maybe you can read it, because I have lots of notes, remember?
Right, I was just trying to balance things out, like in class.
Oh my goodness. Well, one thing I really liked about her presentation on attachment styles is she made sure to over and over call them attachment strategies that were in response to the caregivers showing up or not showing up. So it's like the caregiver's presence or lack of presence dictated the child's strategy. Whoa, I think I have it written down somewhere.
I like this because it points out the response to what the child is experiencing, as opposed to making it sound like a preference. Like, right. Oh, I'm usually avoidant, and you're usually pursuing, or anxious, right. Or preoccupied, or whichever word you want to use for it. That's not the same as, I am literally authentically responding to what is happening to me.
Right. So this isn't a direct quote, but it's what I wrote down as a summary. She said that attachment styles that are not secure are strategies to coexist with the insufficiencies of their caregiver's presence.
Ow!
Uh-huh.
That stepped all over my toes and punched me in the gut at the same time.
I'm sorry. It's hard though, right? But also, it's like not blaming the child.
Right.
It's not like the child's avoidant. It's like the child is trying to figure out how to coexist with this caregiver who's insufficient in their presence.
Right. I think that's really, really important. Not just because I'm an avoidant person and I would like someone to have compassion upon my soul, but because she's saying, and she said explicitly, this is not about behavior problems of children. This is about what children are experiencing in response to the kind of caregiving they are having to navigate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can you read that one more time?
Mm. All attachment types that are not secure are strategies to coexist with the insufficiencies of their caregiver's presence.
So to make this explicit, meaning clear, where we can all agree on what this is saying, when we talk about attachment styles, what it makes it sound like is that some people do it this way, some people do it this way, we all have different preferences, and the way that looks in unhealthy ways
are us doing it wrong.
Yeah.
I want to add this to my plenary. It's not in my plenary that was pre-recorded as the dress rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
But when I give it, I feel like this needs to go on the slide about ways we could say things differently.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, mom flashback.
Whoa.
That's an adverb. It is an L-Y. Differently. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So, I would, if I can retain this mm-hmm. long enough, and I don't know
until
that I can,
Sunday.
I want to add to that slide both about saying activated instead of triggered
mm-hmm.
and about attachment strategies rather than attachment styles.
Yeah. It's a big deal, right?
The other thing to make explicit about this quote, about this paraphrasing, is what you said a minute ago, is that it's not the child's fault.
Right.
This is not bad behavior of the child. Oh, I am in the group of children that did not run to my mother when she showed up.
Right.
I'm in the group of children who pushed away my mother. That's right. Not what's happening. It's in response to what they are experiencing from what is coming that isn't safe, or the relational trauma of the good that is missing.
Right. It's not a fussy baby. It is a baby responding to the insufficiency of the caregiver.
It is not a needy, greedy baby.
Can I say that there are a lot of things about this presentation that I would like to make explicit, but not in the everyone known way, in the bleepity bleep kind of way.
Sorry. Right?
It's so hard.
Okay, so say the quote one more time for people taking notes.
Yeah. All attachment types that are not secure are strategies to coexist with the insufficiencies of their caregiver's presence.
So paraphrasing your paraphrase.
Yeah.
You are not the problem. The insufficient care is the problem.
Yeah.
We don't even have to be disrespectful to parents or only blame parents. They could also have trauma or whatever is going on with them. This is not about the binary blame or hatred or vitriol against anyone, because right. It is a brave space.
Right.
We are creating brave spaces and holding space for all the things. So they may have all of their stuff, whatever their stuff is, but our experience of our caregiver is not our fault.
Right.
Our response to our experiences with our caregiver is our strategy to cope with and coexist with, which takes us back to betrayal trauma,
mm-hmm.
that we have to maintain an attachment with the caregivers we have.
Right.
To cope with and to coexist with the crap that belongs to our parents and is not even our fireball.
Right.
That's what attachment strategy is.
Mm-hmm. When it's not the healthy, internalized working model of a secure caregiver.
Which means care enough.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first example of this was avoidant attachment strategy. And in her slide, people in the community can see this, but in her slide, she made it really obvious. She heads it avoidant attachment. But then under that, it says strategy : avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
So avoidant attachment style really is just attachment strategy using avoidance to try to be safe and receive enough care.
Yeah.
So in other words, this goes back to our new book where we talk about social contracts
mm-hmm.
and social contracts with our family of origin being the things that we are permitted to express and the things that we need to do in order to receive approval, which our brain reads as safety,
right,
and to avoid punishment or rejection, which our brain reads as danger.
Yes. Life-threatening danger.
Life-threatening danger. It doesn't mean, I want to be careful about saying that, or be careful with that, because we have people, not us, we're fine, but we have listeners who have relational trauma, and this is the moment where they think, oh, my trauma doesn't count because it wasn't this kind or this kind or this kind. Not that either of us in this room.
I don't have bruises, so it wasn't real, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the bruise literally landed on your sense of self.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, was that one step too far?
Perfect.
So remember, again, listeners, it's so much to unpack. Our brains read anything that threatens our existence as danger. That can be actual danger, like a tiger about to eat us, or it can be metaphorical danger, like being a very small child looking at the tiger that is a picture of a tiger, or maybe the tiger's in the zoo or something, right? Mm-hmm. Just trying to keep it safe. And also, because we are mammals, and mammals need to be part of the herd, or the community, or the tribe. We are pack animals. We need community to feel safe in all of the signals and everything happening in our brain. So when we have relational trauma, even if it is not a punch in the face, I don't want anyone to get punched in the face, but even if it is not a black eye, even if the bruise is relational, our brains, and especially when it is relational, because it is a threat to our community-ness, a threat to being included in the pack that keeps us alive.
A threat to belonging.
Which ultimately is how we are defined through social contracts. That is a threat to our life, according to our brain. Even if your home is very lovely, or if you have enough food or enough clothes, relational trauma has a bigger impact neurologically than physical or sexual abuse, which we know are bad. That was Simone Reinder's research 2 years ago. fMRI studies, like actual science, not theory, confirmed. We have images of it, like that's a thing.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about these hard things, it is including and especially relational trauma, which makes it especially hard to listen to, and why this session was so activating.
Right.
So for avoidance as a attachment strategy specifically, she gave examples or explained this as a response to distant, rejecting, and unavailable caregivers. It teaches you to edit the self, like, you know, I don't know, taking down podcast episodes, deleting things, throwing things away, let's make it all go away.
Splitting and retiring posts because there needs to be a new one, apparently normal part, right?
Right. Showing needs, emotions, and true self. Oh, let me say that differently in English. Showing that if... I don't know how to say that in English.
Well,
what is the next one?
It just says...
Showing that...
Showing needs, emotions, and your true self result in rejection.
In rejection.
Right.
So you learn... When we've had to do avoidance strategy is when we have learned that showing needs, showing emotions, or showing the true self results in rejection, which again, to your brain, is a life-threatening danger.
Yes.
When you're a child. Not showing needs, emotions, or your true self will protect the relationship with the caregiver.
Yes.
If someone wants to read more about that, I would look up betrayal trauma theory,
mm-hmm.
which is that next step of attachment theory where it talks about to maintain, like the whole point of dissociation is to maintain attachment to our caregiver when we can't get away and stay alive, and also
expressing needs or emotions makes them reject us.
So it's so trippy and it's so hard to wrap our brains around. Literally, to continue existing, you are required to act as if you do not exist.
Yes.
So to survive, you have to stop existing.
That's quite the double bind.
And it doesn't even, that doesn't even include physical or sexual abuse.
Right.
That is pure relational stuff.
Yeah.
Just saying that again explicitly for the people who are like, oh, mine doesn't count because it wasn't that bad. This is actually worse.
Yeah. So she also, while she was talking about that, mentioned that in the attachment studies with Mary Ainsworth years and years, probably decades and decades ago, what they found is that dismissive caregivers, so like the caregivers of the children that were seen as using the avoidance strategy, those caregivers would actually hug the babies and show them attention. And the only moments that they didn't is in the specific moments that a child requested care, like crying or showing distress. When that happened, the caregivers would turn away and avoid the child. How messed up is that? I'm sorry.
It makes me so nauseous.
I know.
That's the first time I almost left because that was so heavy.
Yeah.
So again, I know I'm repeating a lot of these things, but it's so hard to hear and tolerate that we just have to keep rephrasing.
Right.
Avoidance as an attachment strategy
mm-hmm.
happens when we have caregivers who only offer us care when it is meaningful to them in some way. And specifically, do not offer us care when we ask for care.
Right.
Or initiate requests for care.
Which makes sense that it would teach children to reject the self and dissociate from the self. Because those are the moments that they lose attachment.
We literally learn that asking for our needs to be met is what will get those needs rejected, get us rejected and those needs unmet.
Right, which means those needs, having needs, is dangerous because it's a threat to our attachment.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's how it gets untangled.
That's how it gets tangled, and then how we have to untangle it as adults.
Right, that's what I meant. I meant it's like trying to understand a math equation of why this and this and this, because it's all process.
Yeah.
But that is the untangling of how the process breaks down. But really, it is our self that is being broken down.
Yeah.
So we learn self-sufficiency. This is when we see over-functioning, over-independence. I don't have needs. I'm not going to ask for help. I don't even need help. Why do you think there's something wrong with me? Because I'm fine.
Uh-huh.
A bias towards self-regulation. I do not need you to co-regulate with me. And in fact, you trying to co-regulate with me actually upsets the apple cart, as they say.
Right.
Ugh. The child does not utilize the caregiver as an external regulator because they don't regulate.
Right. Because when they have tried, the caregiver disappears.
So it is not regulating.
No.
It's not just, like, do we understand the implications of this? It's not just that the caregiver is dysregulated. It's that trying to utilize them as a source of safety literally causes them to go away.
Right.
Causes their care to go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the image that comes to mind for me in this is me literally on the floor outside my mother's door as a very young child, crying out for safety and for her to help me deal with what is about to happen to me. And instead of, like, scooping me up or picking me up or even just letting me into her room, of her shutting the door and locking it.
Yeah.
I can't even with this.
Yeah.
Or I'm trying to think of neutral examples to show how relational it is. Which is not
neutral,
but I mean, we think of, oh, don't say this kind of abuse detail or don't say this kind of abuse detail. But all the time we're saying and talking about and acting out these relational pieces. It's why there's so much hurt in the community, because the pain is relational.
Yeah.
I mean, the greater, like, online whole mm-hmm. survivor community. I don't just mean system speak, because it's relational pain.
Yeah. That so often is going unacknowledged and untreated, because there's this idea that it has to be a big T trauma to count, right? So having a dismissive caregiver who was unregulated doesn't count as abuse, when in fact it's so dysregulating and painful for children and adults.
I think it also, we can cut this out if I say anything that's too much, but I think it's also part of what has been hard for us in the past that I feel like we're just now learning to work through, that when you and I get activated at the same time, or even in turn, with your strategies to try to connect more, to me, that feels dangerous.
Right.
But my strategies to not need anything, to you, feels dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, we don't even have the same strategies.
No.
And literally, our strategies felt dangerous to each other. And because we both also learned fawning, because disorganized attachment, which means we have a little bit of both as well.
Right.
Good times. With fawning, then what happened was I could give more than I could tolerate, which wasn't healthy for me. You could pretend things were okay when they're not, which wasn't good for you. But then we also experienced the incongruence of that. When I gave more than I could tolerate, you're saying, but you're not okay. And I'm like, no, I'm fine. And try harder and harder to reassure you when you're literally getting the information that something is wrong.
Yeah.
And I get the experience of you trying to ignore needs and thinking, so this isn't real because I'm sensing this. So really, we're actually experiencing the same thing,
uh-huh.
but through different strategies. And then very confused about why there's incongruence.
Yeah.
And both of us feeling like, does this mean they're going to leave? Does this mean, do they actually love us? Do they not? Are they showing up? Are they not? What does that look like? And it escalates so quickly, like instantly.
Yeah.
And so that is part of why I feel like the work we have done this year, even though it has sucked, has been so powerful. Because it is the foundation to healing these things
mm-hmm.
and understanding what is happening and how to respond in safe ways and how to pace the care in responding, as opposed to Is this happening? Is it not? What is happening? What is not? What is real? What is not? Are we together? Are we not? Like, it has been huge, like breakthrough, huge, epically. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Is that too much?
No. It's making me think about, and I know this episode isn't going to post before the recap, but it makes me think about your talk with Rick Hoffler. Thank you. And a piece that you said was when we're as like integrated, or most of our parts are online. I'm not going to say this right, but when as much of us is there and integrated as possible, we're most vulnerable. And I know we were in that place of trying to be very aware of everything inside when things kind of went south after that unfawning episode. So we were in this place of being very vulnerable when our attachment strategies kind of crosswired.
Right.
Which made it even more intense.
Well, and in that example, we've not talked about this on the podcast because privacy.
Right.
But in that example, we both also, in trying to unfawn, tried to also actually fawn. Where we're like, I'm going to be so solid in this thing, I'm just going to let you do that thing. And we both did it in different ways, where it's like, we also each received that from the other as rejection.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, so what does that even mean? Like, no wonder we couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
Because it is so deep and so hard. What is different, at least for me? I don't want to talk about your stuff. For me, what has been different as we have gone through this over the last year is that you stayed.
Mm-hmm.
So even as we were trying to untangle all of this strategy stuff in therapy, both of us, sometimes together.
Our therapist,
I feel really bad.
Right. We need to send them on a cruise if that was appropriate and ethical. They deserve it. I know it's not, but
it is not
appropriate
and ethical. She won't even let me paint her paintings. Okay. In Oklahoma, you can barter.
Yeah.
But she is not having it because I've had so many therapy ruptures. She's like, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's probably good.
Well, yeah.
I just want to acknowledge the work they have put into holding space for us to do this messy work. It's important.
We are only still together because we have amazing therapists.
Yeah.
The podcast only still exists because we have amazing therapists. I'm not kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I add a piece that's probably too much and will need to come out? But I just want to say it. I think for me, and I might have already said this, but like, when we did the unfawning, like, I know I've been trying to have needs and let people in, let you in, and then you broke your ankle. And then we did the unfawning. And so it was like, activated so much of like, no, you do not get to actually be a person and have needs because you're literally killing people around you. Like, that's what it felt like.
But that's what I feel like all the time with Dante. Everything is evidence that God is mad at me because I have done something wrong.
That's not... Like, I didn't break your ankle.
You did not break my ankle, love.
You are not doing things wrong and hurting me.
I was not trying... I think I did hurt you, but not trying to hurt you.
Right.
In fact, I was overly fawning, trying to do what you asked.
Right? So messed up.
Wait. I am too. I am sorry. But that's what's different is you have stayed.
So have you.
Yeah. We did. That's a big deal. Gold stars all around.
Yeah.
So back to avoidance strategies. But look Yeah, we are talking about that. That is less avoidance.
Yeah.
So even in small things, you and I even are really careful with like what we want to eat or not. What is the difference between fawning and accommodating? Do I really care that I don't care? Is it actually true that I don't care what we eat this particular time? And do I really speak up other times where I do, like, no, I'm actually hungry for this thing or my body needs this thing?
Yeah.
But we're checking in and every decision becoming part of consent.
Yeah.
So that it's not fawning, but it's also not avoiding, and having new muscles that to me, at least on my end, are really starting to feel strong of being able to have hard conversations, even about simple things, so that we're navigating things in the moment rather than it taking months or lots of therapy to untangle. And that to me is beautiful, even if we still have ages to go of healing.
Yeah.
Okay, so an avoidance strategy.
Mm-hmm.
We left off, the child does not utilize the caregiver as an external regulator.
Right.
Moves to the next one, moves to exploration despite danger.
Right. So she talked about this being like people will take risks even though it's really dangerous, because they're not able to see danger or understand that they need protecting.
So it says distance, disengagement, and detachment become part of avoidance.
And hypoarousal.
And then also distances from self.
Right.
Where I'm like, I know I have a system. I know I have a diagnosis of DID. There's evidence literally right now in this hotel room all around me of all the different people that are here in this room. And also, they are far away and not a part of me. They're just part of the system. Part of not the collective.
Yeah.
Not a part of me. And so far away I cannot hear or see them.
Right.
I do not need to respond to them or tend to them or interact with them in any way at all.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Do you feel that way about yourself? Like that you're also distant from yourself?
Yes.
What trips me out a lot for me is I think internally I have predominantly avoidance strategies, like internally, so amongst myself.
Are we acknowledging that today?
No.
Did you find your DID again?
No.
Was it here in Texas?
Maybe it was here in Texas the whole time.
It was in that Skittles drink.
my candy wine. Ooh, if that's not DID, right? Candy and wine together? No.
Right?
No. It's fabulous, by the way.
I did not.
No, you
have
didn't
candy
like
wine.
It. Or you were not even interested in candy wine.
Not interested in candy wine.
Internally, though, I have a lot of this avoidant strategy.
Yes!
Where I don't even know myself.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So, like, when you're talking about building that muscle of knowing what you're needing, I feel like that's a piece that's still really hard for me. And not because I'm not looking. Like, I really am trying to look, almost maybe in a fawning way of trying to get it right. There's just... it's really hard to get any information. It's still not very...
Oh, I don't mean I'm building muscles with me. No. I'm building relational muscles with you.
Well, when you were saying, like, listening to see if you really were okay with any food or if there was a food you did want, like, even those things are still really hard for me to get any kind of messages about. So it's not that I'm avoiding them. They're just still not turned on.
It's the candy wine. That'll turn them on.
Like, the lights are out still, you know?
So for me, where I'm at right now, this person shirt experience of a self, where I am at is absolutely having zero interaction in the same way internally. Except that what I do just within the last year, like maybe since my new therapist, and I don't know why, but something in the last year, whether it's stuff you and I have learned, whether it's something else clicked into place, I don't know what helped it settle. And I don't even know that it's a piece I get to keep, right? I feel like some things I learn and then they slip away and I have to learn them again. And it just takes a lot of practice to be able to hold on to it. But for now, this piece, for whatever reason, feels very settled in that. I don't know how to explain it, because I don't necessarily feel in my body or aware of my body, but for some reason and in some way, I do have communication happening with my body. My body, maybe because of relational maybe because of religious trauma is part of where that's coming from, balancing that, I'm not sure. But right now, for this season, and I don't want to jinx it, I am very in touch with when my body feels okay and when it does not feel okay. I don't always get a clear message about what that's about or who is feeling what or why they're feeling that. But I have somehow learned to click into place. It was because of us. It was everything that happened last fall when I was asking all the question of, do I want to be poly? Do I not? Do I want to be married? Do I not? Do I want this? Do I not? It was through all of that and us working through all this stuff into this spring and deciding, I want you.
Yeah, baby.
I feel better with you. And I don't just mean preference or lust or anything like that. I mean, neurologically, with you, my body settles. And that's not just because anything is easy, because you and I have worked hard on things.
Yeah, things are not easy. But they're
healthy.
Yeah. And that feels easier than other things I've done because we're doing them in a healthy and like healing way.
This is the point where we bring up again, what is the word that is the opposite of trauma bonding? That's what we're doing. Healing bonding. It is something very powerful and good. Yeah. So I am learning from those experiences and being able to apply in other situations. I don't know what the answers are. I don't know who or why or what that has to do with me systemically, but I have learned to say and feel and experience, does my body feel better and settled with this, or does my body feel dysregulated?
Yeah.
And that has been really important working through the last year and navigating what choices I want to make for my future and even my present. Mm-hmm. And it has been a big part of working through religious trauma of who is even telling me the truth.
Oh, yeah.
And how do I even know what the truth is? You know who tells me the truth? My body tells me the truth.
Yeah.
Because while we, both of us, were learning unfawning, but in my experience of our relationship with unfawning, it would feel like you were not telling me the truth, not because you were lying to me, but because fawning, is it still real if it was fawning? And now if you're not fawning, does that mean that's real or this is, like I couldn't, when we were so new and it was so hard, for me it really dysregulated my experience of reality.
Yeah.
Every week I went to therapy. I don't know what's real. Is this real or is this real? Is this real or is this real? Working through that and learning it is my body that will tell me the truth. I know. It's giving me some confidence. Like, I know this is good for me or not good for me. It happened to keep it neutral in public. It happened with all the online drama too, because my experience of ISSTD has been very positive historically. Yeah. They collectively have been very kind and generous to me. I have also worked really hard on a lot of different teams with a lot of different people. And through that hard work, like, ISSTD isn't like an institution of like no names and faces.
Right.
It is literally a volunteer-based institution with people in the trenches the same as me. I am only speaking from my own lived experience.
Yeah.
And through that hard work of meetings and plannings and events and the experiences of all that goes into that, clinical work together, different things like that, I have built relationships. So when I talk about ISSTD, I am not talking about an institution.
Right.
I am talking about this face or this face or this face, all of whom have lived experience.
Right. You're talking about a community of professionals whom you have come to know well and collaborate with and have been kind and accepting to you, right?
Yes. It feels to me very much like the community, except professional focused instead of what happened in therapy this week focused.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So
it's more of what are we going to do in therapy next week?
Right? How am I going to help?
Right.
So that is my lived experience. And then when everything happened last year and there's all this drama of, oh, this hurt me or this hurt me. Like, I also have the online community generally of, we all have shared lived experience in different ways and that looks like different things. But there's also a lot of experiences that's not my experience.
Yeah.
But when people are hurt, I want to tend to that hurt. So I care about people and want to like acknowledge and honor their pain. And also there's a lot of online people who have just been really mean to me.
Right.
And I'm not interested in engaging with that. So one thing I love about the Brave Spaces concept is how it sets up explicit boundaries for giving care.
Yeah.
And so that helped me a lot, but I had to learn through the noise of everything that happened last year how to honor pain and also stay true to myself, both with ISSTD and with lived experience. It was not my parents divorcing. It really wasn't.
Right.
Some people were hurt because they were directly impacted. Other people supported people who were hurting, and other people appropriated that for their own good to either troll or market or whatever. I think that's exploitive as much as what happened.
Yeah.
So it took me a long time to understand myself enough to understand what I was feeling in response to all of that. And it has taken me the years since to come back to just standing in my own space of, this is me and this is who I am. And I'm here to just be myself. I don't actually have to pick sides. There aren't sides in healthy, brave spaces.
Right.
I don't have to fawn or endorse or participate in ways that my body says that's not good for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay for me to say no. It's okay for me to pace things. Like the plenary this year, that's the only thing I did. Right? For me, all of that taught me to just listen to my body. I don't mean to be going, I know, thorough. I'm being thorough. I don't mean to go off on a tangent, but that's literally how I've practiced it the last year. when everyone is saying something different and I don't know who's telling the truth or why things are activating me, what I can listen to is my body. What settles my body and what distresses my body.
Yeah.
What? You're smiling.
Well, it's just hard sometimes to get messages from my body still.
I'm sorry that it's hard.
That's okay. It's just weird to be so avoidant internally when that really is not the strategy externally. Because I think externally I'm much more of an anxious attachment strategy person.
That may be something, I mean, I know you'll take it to therapy, but it may be something that just unfolds itself over time of why that is.
Yeah.
Why you would use one strategy internally and why you would use a different strategy externally.
Well, and I wonder if, I mean, we'll get there. We haven't even gotten to the anxious attachment strategy yet. But like when we were talking earlier about addiction and it looking at like lots of different things, I think she mentioned being addicted to caretaking. We'll get to that. And I think that was one of the moments where I wanted to run out of the room.
Ooh, yeah. Let's go there. What were some of the things that she said about that slide? Was there anything we left out? Because I am talking to a void instead of listening to what she said.
Yeah. Well, one thing she pointed out is that it's really important to reevaluate how we see self-sufficiency in young children. Because right now, a lot of times we see that as, oh, they're really mature and they're taking care of themselves and they don't need things and they're not disruptive, and that's a good thing, right? We praise that. But actually what it can mean is that it's a sign of attachment trauma, because they have this avoidance strategy because of a lack of presence in their caregiver. So that's not actually a good thing.
One of my outside children, and I don't want to say more about which one because that's not appropriate for the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But I have dealt with this at their school because they are such a fawner,
mm-hmm.
that they will literally reward my child for this thing.
Yeah.
Over independence, over fawning. And that is always when that child is in crisis.
Yeah.
And I'm like, instead of saying and reinforcing, good job being independent, that is when you need to stop and ask, what do you need? How can I help? And help that child learn how to use words to ask for what they need and to receive their needs being met.
Yeah.
Because I can do that at home. I can do that with the child, but I cannot do it for them at school. And school, unfortunately, I have other children where I'm like, please, you need all the school you can get,
mm-hmm.
because social skills or because exposure to childhood, and you need that. But this child, I feel like it has backfired with them because the school, like the educational system, rewards fawning.
Yeah.
And I see it happening of they are getting trained, like they are getting sicker because they are being trained in how to do this more.
Right. How to fawn more.
Mm-hmm. It's so sad. I can see it in real time and I cannot make it stop. Like I can't rescue that child from that.
Yeah. So I thought that was an important piece, that like when you see an easy child or an easy baby, like that might be a sign that something's wrong for the child.
An easy baby is a needy baby because the baby has needs.
Mm-hmm.
because they're human, not because they're wrong. And if there is a baby that is needy, it does not mean the baby is wrong. It means the care has not been given, and that's why there are needs that are not met. If the baby has their needs met, they are not still needing.
Have we talked about where the needy baby, greedy baby comes from?
No!
Maybe we should do that because it's been coming up. So there's a TV show called The Big Bang Theory, which probably a lot of people know. It was pretty popular. But one of the characters, one of the main characters' mother is a psychologist or psychiatrist or a researcher or something, and has published books. And one of her books was Needy Baby, Greedy Baby. And she was a horribly dismissive parent, like not good at all. So that's where that comes from.
And your therapist said what about it?
Oh, she said...
Sorry, we don't have to.
I don't have the actual quote, but she said something about needy baby, greedy baby is not a helpful or useful way to talk about my needs. Something like that. But she did agree that it is a funny way to talk about my needs.
It is a reenactment way to talk about your needs, where you are dismissing the actual valid needs that you are still waiting for care.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to get sick. Are you okay?
I'm wonderful.
It's great.
No, I'm okay. Yeah.
Okay. We can pause that and I'll just let it be your fireball for therapy. This conversation will be continued on the next episode. Thank you for listening. Your support of the podcast, the workbooks, and the community means so much to us as we try to create something together that's never been done before. Not like this. Connection brings healing. And you can join us on the community at www.systemspeak.com. We'll see you there.